So I gotta calm down. I rest of that.
Good morning, teacher.
Good morning, student.
She's at 95 now.
What's it?
Yeah, 95.
I guess. No, we don't. We have 80. We have a person more than 80. It's all illusion beyond that. Okay. All right, so we're going to meditate as we normally do. We're going to meditate at the beginning, but I'll give you a little preamble to that. And again, you can do any kind of meditation you want. You don't have to do mindfulness. This is just a suggestion for you. So 2 weeks ago, I told you that the most basic instruction for mindfulness is just keep coming back to your breathing. Just keep returning attention to your breathing. Let everything else be just as it is. But come back to your breathing so you come out of being lost in whatever it is that's happening. And you notice it. And every time you get absorbed in your thoughts or your feelings or sensations, you come back to your breathing and it brings you out of absorption. You don't try to change anything. You're not trying to get rid of thoughts or feelings. You're just coming back to your breathing and softening and opening. And that was the second instruction, which I gave last week, which is as you come back to your breathing, just soften everything. Soften your body, soften your mind, soften your heart. So you become spacious. And you breathe, and there's a thought, and there's another thought, and there's a worry, and it absorbs you for 5 minutes, and then you go, oh my God, where's my breathing? You come back to your breathing, and you soften, and you open, and there's a worry, and it absorbs you for another 5 minutes. Okay, so the process is a process of coming back to the breathing and opening up and creating space in which thoughts, feelings, and sensations can come and go without getting absorbed in them, without trying to battle them or change them. Now, if you're the sky, it's a lot easier to experience a rainstorm than when you're underneath the rainstorm. So when you come back to your breathing, it's like taking a step back from thoughts, feelings, and sensations, and just breathing and softening and opening, and there's the storm. It's not you anymore, it's something that you are noticing. And that's life-saving, is to not have to change any of that stuff, but simply to disidentify from it and become larger than it. And you do that, again, you don't try to, you can't think your way into this kind of thing. It's just breathing, relaxing, opening, creating space in which everything can be just as it is. So, another way to look at this, when the show is really horrible, really terrifying, or really beguiling, you forget that you're sitting in the armchair watching the me show, and you become the me show. In fact, we spend our whole lives in the me show. When you breathe and you soften and you open, you realize that you're watching the me show. My thoughts, my feelings, my sensations, but they're not really you. They're what you're watching. You are the awareness in which that stuff comes and goes and does whatever it does. Right? So when you are witnessing the me show, when you're noticing what's going on, two important things happen. One important thing is what we're talking about in the last couple of weeks and what we're really going to talk about today, which is different things enter the me show. Different things rise into awareness. Things that were formerly sub and super conscious become conscious. So there's an evolution of the me show. So it isn't just the same old, I'm worried about this, I wish I were that, blah, blah, blah. You know, after a while, as you sit and you breathe and you open, space is created so that things which were formerly not realized become realized. So there's an evolution of the me show. The channel starts to permute, it starts to change, and it starts to change in salubrious, that is, healthy directions. As you start to learn, become a more integrated person, learn more of who you are, because your awareness is open enough so more and more stuff can enter awareness. So that's the first benefit of being in the armchair, not stuck in the big screen TV. And then the second, also not being stuck in the big screen TV means when it's a horror show, you can appreciate it rather than being the protagonist in it. And then there's another effect here, which is you begin to realize that the me show ain't me. That what you took for yourself, that is your thoughts, your feelings, and your sensations, your body, that's not really who you are. You are the awareness in which thoughts, feelings, and sensations happen. So you begin to disidentify from this stuff, and instead of therapizing it, instead of spending your whole life trying to change this and make this better and make this, you realize it's just a stupid show. And when you become this, you realize that this has a different quality than this. This is all caught up and struggling, and you know, and this is boundless, always aware, peaceful, spacious. And then you have the possibility in your life to be the show when the show is working, and to step back from the show when the show isn't working and come from a different place. So you're arguing with somebody and you realize it's not getting anywhere, it's just getting worse and worse and worse. So you breathe. Let's start this again. And you come back from it. You come from a different place. You take a step back. You find the peace and the openness. And you don't have to insist that you're right anymore. You just can listen and take in what's happening. So this is a more isolated, bounded kind of way of being. And this is a completely open, receptive, calm way of being. So let's sit, okay? So the great... let the me show be just as it is. If as you watch the me show, pain arises, just watch the pain. If pleasure arises, just watch the pleasure. Come out of trying to rearrange the me show and just keep returning attention to your breathing, softening and opening, and entertaining whatever the show is. So we'll sit for 10 minutes. And even if you're lost for 9 minutes and 59 seconds, when you return to your breathing and you realize that you were lost in thought, that's mindfulness. The returning to your breathing and the realization that you have come out of absorption.
I there are about 2 minutes left. So if you're lost in thought, you might come to your breathing and soften and open.
If we put the shades up, do you think we could do without the lights? I don't have that much to write on the board, so let's do that. If possible, we can pull those shades up. No? Oh, will it be too late?
I can do it.
Now, let's see if there's going to be too much sun in people's eyes. Just fabulous. That's all right. Now, okay. So if that doesn't work, let me know. We'll turn the lights on if we need to. Let me know if you can't hear me, and I'll use a microphone. A couple of announcements, and then we have a little journey to take. First, in 2 weeks, in this class, Peter Wright, who's sitting here and who is a member of the class, and is a certified past life regression therapist, will be talking to us about past lives and past life regression. So that's happening in 2 weeks. There's kind of a lot of stuff that's kind of all constellated together here, actually, including that dovetails with what we're talking about today in this class. So, Mind and Supermind on October 25th, Friday night, which I think costs $6. We had a partial subsidy for that. That's Dr. Jim Kwako talking about heaven as a state of consciousness potentially available to all of us. So we've got past lives, we've got heaven, okay, October 25th. Then William Peters, who many of you know and has come to this class three times, has two things that he's doing. One is a free lecture Wednesday, October 16th at Cottage Hospital. He's going to be talking about the the shared death experience. When you are with somebody who is dying and you go through that experience with them. And then he's got his 8-week series that several of you have taken, probably maybe many of you, Life Beyond Death. That does cost money. There's flyers for both those things, the free thing and the Life Beyond Death. That 8-week series, people have gotten a lot out of that series. Just noticing here, this is off the subject, but Freda Spierka, who's a yoga teacher here at CLL, here are some flyers for her excellent classes. You take these. But so far we talked about past lives, we talked about heaven, we talked about shared death experience. Today we're going to talk a little bit about the experience of death and rebirth. So these things are all kind of coming together in a synchronous way. But before we do that, wanted to let you know that at 11:30 today, when the class officially ends, if you need to leave, walk quickly. But what we're going to have happen today is several things. It's going to end with a poem by Abraham. But the thing that I'm most excited about is Laura Wilkinson, who's a class member, is going to show us on the screen some of her beautiful and deep art, and is going to kind of guide us through a little, because if you just see the art, you react to it because it's obviously beautiful, but you don't understand it as deeply as if the artist says, look, this is what's happening, and then it just opens up for you. So that's going to happen at 11:30, okay? So if possible, well, you know that it's happening, okay? If you ever want to have that happen for you, then arrange it with me. In terms of bringing your art in, there's a lot of art here at 11:30 before we do the presentation here. We'll just kind of go around and people can point out their art and say whatever they want about it. So bring your art in. And of course you can... Because this is a weekly art game. So, any concerns or questions before we head into the unconscious?
There was a really interesting stage talk yesterday. Excuse me.
Loud.
Oh, sorry. I think I may have mentioned this a few years ago in the class. There was a study at Stanford a few years ago that showed that there is no such thing as multitasking. And that when people think they're multitasking, they're not. There's no metacognition of how they're not doing it. But anyway, the guy who did the study spoke yesterday at UCSB, and he had so many interesting things to say, but I just wanted to say one thing especially relevant to something you were saying earlier. A few years ago, there was this promise of virtual reality where you could put on headphones and things and you could immerse yourself in this whole virtual world. He said that something very strange has happened culturally in the last few years. It turns out that people don't want that. It turns out that multitasking has become such an addiction for people that the idea of immersing yourself in another world is just frightening, and they don't want to do it. They want to be able to constantly be flitting around. Anyway, it reminded me a little bit of what you were saying, talking about the Me Show. Yeah.
That they don't want to get too deep into anything.
Yeah, he talked about how, you know, you go back for, you know, most of the 20th century, people would go to the movies, you know, to escape into another world. And he says people don't want to do that anymore. If they go to the movies, they're sitting there texting or something else. He said, he's a professor at Stanford University, and he said that the average Stanford student is doing 3.5 media streams at once.
Oh,
yeah.
Who was this?
His name is Nas, N-A-A-S.
Okay, I don't know.
Anyway, but he did this study that I was ranting about a few years ago because it had very practical consequences about people, like doing hands-free talking on the phone while they're driving. And, of course, that's actually more dangerous than holding the phone in your hand. So, yeah, but people don't have that metacognition of that. But, yeah.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, so yeah. He said a lot of very interesting things, but I just wanted to comment on that one.
Actually,
thing.
In a couple of weeks, this will probably be relevant again.
Oh, okay, because I have tons of notes. I could say a lot more.
All right, well, probably when we do it again.
Okay.
All right, so we're actually going to do the opposite of skating on the surface. We're going deeper. So here we go. It took me 2 weeks to set this up. Today's the day. All right, we're making a map. We've been making a map of the mind or of consciousness. What do we got? Make it over here. This is the personal unconscious. So what we said so far is a lot more is happening in your mind and in your brain than you're aware of. Information processing point of view, there's maybe 100,000 times more information coming in than you know about consciously, but that information is all useful to you and is helping you navigate the world. In other words, it is motivating you whether you know it or not. You're taking in all the sensory information, you're doing comparisons with situations in your past and what happened in those situations, and then you're coming up with action strategies, all of which happen without your awareness. So that's one way to look at this, what's in your unconscious. It's just a lot of information getting crunched. The analogy would be, you're the display on your computer. You just see a very little of what's actually going on in the computer that results in that display. Okay? Other ways to look at what's in your unconscious. I told you about Sigmund Freud, who said that every moment of your life there's an unconscious battle going on between your biology, what I want right now, I'm hungry, I'm tired, I'm this, I'm that, you know, and go get it, you know, that's the id. And the reason you don't go get it immediately is because the superego, the social rules say, you can't do that, you can't just fall asleep in class, you just can't walk out, that's a bad, you know, that would be you bad boy, you bad girl. So there's this constant battle between the biological imperatives and the social rules. And you're not aware of any of that on a conscious level. You're just trying to make it through the world without dying and pissing anybody off. So that's what Freud said. Now, that's true. That these days in psychodynamic theory, we think that, there is some friction between your biology and the social rules, but that's not the hundredth of it. What's really a more broadly happening in you right now and what you could potentially become aware of, conscious of. So the consciousness, what we're aware of is a very little bit of what we potentially could become aware of. So we're gradually deepening our understanding of what's motivating us right now and what we potentially could become aware of consciously. So potentially we could become aware of our entire learning history. That is, every moment your mind is assessing what the situation is, what your history is in similar situations, and then coming up with an adjustment of your body and an action plan for how to deal with that situation. So if this situation, we heard bad noises outside, you know, or noises that were unsettling, your mind would immediately go, ever hear anything like that before? Yeah, that was a bad thing that happened, and your body would be like this, and you'd be in fight or flight in an instant. That's survival. So you're constantly monitoring that, or if there was a noise of an ice cream truck going by outside, suddenly
your mouth would water, and you're, you know, oh, let's go get that, you know. So you're constantly being influenced by your learning history in every situation. And that's another way to look at what's in your personal unconscious. We can also look at the fact that there are genes that are influencing you. That is, your genes are saying, I'm depressed, or I'm ecstatic, or, you know, and that's being filtered through your history. So the genes kind of start the process, and then your personal history tailors how you act on those genetic imperatives. So that's what we said so far. There's a lot of stuff biologically and psychologically going on underneath your awareness, which is determining who you are at present. So is that the end of it?
No.
Well, it turns out that ain't the 100th of it. I'm going to have to read this. I abrogated what I'm going to read to you from Stan Grof, but I really think I need to use his words here, because A, you won't believe me, and B, he's got a little more practice at saying this, and he also had a lot of time to write it. So I'm going to kind of bring you on a journey a little deeper than your personal unconscious. Basically, what Stanislav Grof, G-R-O-F, says is, in deep experiential work, when people become aware of levels of consciousness that are generally not available to them, they run into a level of consciousness that... Grof said that the personal unconscious is arranged by coex systems. That is, our personal experiences are kind of stacked on top of one another depending on the emotional tone or the physical events that happen. So a current example of feeling really nurtured and really, really unified with somebody or something else is stacked on an earlier and earlier and earlier and earlier experiences until you get to the experience of being an infant nurtured in your mother's arms. So the personal unconscious is ordered in terms of these coex systems of condensed experience, which are kind of... the axis of each of these coex systems is an emotional and physical set of events. So there's a coex system for all events when you felt particularly put upon. And that goes back to very early events. But we're going beyond that now. Okay, this is all personal unconscious, and that's where we've been. What Grof says is, when people go deep in themselves in various ways, and what are the various ways? Some... depends on who you are, whether these will be suspect to you. And so one way to look at all this is just human imagination. There's no reality to this, if you want to look at it that way. These are just druggy dreams. You know. Another way to look at this is people having psychedelic experiences have a tendency to uncover or experience kind of systematically various kinds of experiences. There isn't random what happens on a psychedelic trip. These same experiences come up when people have spontaneous mystical experiences, in deep meditation or deep hypnosis, in holotropic breath work, in other in ecstatic dance, in other non-ordinary states of consciousness. There's a tendency to move deeper than the level of the personal unconscious, to a level that Grof calls the perinatal area. Peri means around, natal means birth. And it turns out that the experiences of the personal unconscious of your life history are built on these deeper foundations of the actual circumstances of your physical birth. Now again, the controversy here in transpersonal psychology is, when you get to this area, is it primarily a physical death and rebirth that you're experiencing? It turns out that birth is a death of intrauterine experience and a birth of extrauterine experience. So there's actually a death of one world and a rebirth into another world. That is the pattern of the birth experience. The question is this primarily a physical event that we recall and that patterns us, or is it basically a spiritual event? The Wilburians would say this might have some physical memory attached to it, but it's basically a spiritual death and rebirth. Another way to say this whole process is, as you grow as a human being, you become more conscious of the things that influence you moment by moment, and you're more able to deal with those formerly unconscious influences. At a certain point, you hit a level in your growth of death and rebirth. What dies is the you thought you were. You know, you've heard the word ego death? Mm-hmm. What dies is the false sense of self, the ego. And what is born in this death-rebirth process is a larger human being. So you can look at it that way, that it isn't a descent to earlier and earlier in your life. It's a remembrance of earlier and earlier, deeper and deeper phenomena in your consciousness in the service of an ascent to the future, to a larger sense of who you are. But that growth to a larger sense of who you are involves remembering and reliving aspects from back in your life that are still motivating you, that are still constraining you, and especially your physical birth. That's what Stan is saying. Is in order to become enlightened, you have to kind of go through a divine comedy process. And it ends up a comedy, but it ain't a comedy when you're going through it, and that's what we're going to talk about now. There was a hand, and then I've got to take you through it, or start you through it. Macklin.
Yeah, thank you. It's my hand. I need to have you go over it. I know you've done it before, and that has to do with the consciousness and the body. When you use consciousness, I don't usually move into my body, and yet I think it's really important for those sensations.
What Graf says about the Wilburians and others is they try to stay in their heads. Yeah. This process of growth is not primarily a head process. It's primarily a full being process, especially a body process. So what you're going to hear is body, 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 body. Okay. The experiences, as you grow, the experiences kind of become more central and more visceral, is what Stan is saying. And this is a reason that a lot of people love to hear this stuff, but not many people want to do it. All right, so here we go. You know, I don't think I can read this with the light. I think I got to turn it off. I think I'll turn it off. Well, let's try. A holotropic mind.
It's okay.
Yeah, it's all right. Yeah. We'll live. Yeah, maybe we need all the light we can get for this. All right. Okay. If anybody wants the MP3 of my opening class, it's here. Come after.
It's now up.
And it's now up on swt.org/Spencer. That's where you... Is the first one up, or is the first and second one up?
It's that one.
First one.
Yeah, and I'm sorry I was slow to put it up, but it's up there now.
Okay, and then the second one will get up there too, yeah?
Yeah, Michael just gave it to me.
Perfect, okay. All right, so here we go.
And I turn the life stories.
Yeah, we're gonna announce them afterward at the very end. Okay. All right, I'll do the best I can to read you this. And if we don't get through it all today, you're just going to have to be in a long birth process till next week, but we will get through it. Right? As we venture beyond the biographical events of early childhood, we enter into a realm of experience associated with the trauma of biological birth. By the way, he wasn't the first guy to talk about this. Otto Rank, R-A-N-K, a co-worker of Sigmund Freud's, actually talked about the trauma of birth, but I was heretical to Freud, because Freud only went to the level of infancy, and so Rank was kind of a little out there. Graf is still a little out there. Okay. Entering this new territory, we start experiencing emotions and physical sensations of great intensity, often surpassing anything we might consider humanly possible. Here we encounter emotions at two polar extremes, a strange intertwining of birth and death, as if these two aspects of the human experience were somehow one. Along with a sense of life-threatening confinement comes a determined struggle to free oneself and survive. And this is the struggle that many of us replay in our lives. Remember Dante's Divine Comedy? The Cliff's Notes version, which is all I read of it. In the middle of my life, I found myself lost in a dark forest, right? And that begins his descent to hell and then purgatory and then up to heaven, right? That's the progression. That's the growth progression. But the point is, it was in the middle of his life. Many of us in the middle of our lives feel there's something missing or there's something wrong or somehow we're being good boys and girls, but we really haven't got it, what life is really about. And that sends us into this search which eventuates in a larger sense of self and a real fulfillment, but the path of the search isn't up the mountain. The path of the search is through hell and purgatory and then up the mountain. And that's because of the physical patterning of our physical birth. So here we go.
Spence, a clarification. So he's describing an adult going through the rebirth process.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. But he's describing that we recall our physical birth process when we go through a birth process, a second birth. And again, a lot of people don't want to go here. Some people are impelled to go here, and some people are drawn to go through this. Now, the question is, do you have to go through it in the gory detail that he's going to take you through it? And the answer is, I don't know. I wish I could tell you no, but it's kind of turning out yes. Right. Because most people identify this experience with the biological birth trauma, I refer to it as the perinatal realm of the psyche. Okay. Exploration in non-ordinary states of consciousness has provided convincing evidence that we do store memories of perinatal experiences in our psyches, often at a deep cellular level. What we're taught in school is you don't have any memory of this kind of stuff because your brain isn't wired up this way. What he's saying is there is memory of this. It's just a different set of memories. There's a different area in which memories are stored. Those of you who know Sheldrake, think maybe morphic fields here, or Deepak Chopra's idea that we're really a field of energy and information. Okay, so those of you who know Hinduism, you know there's this astral body that the physical body is patterned by, this energy body. Those of you who do energy work, this is energy. Yeah. All right.
Or Bruce Lipton and cells having a memory.
Right, or cellular memory. Okay. Anyway, people with no intellectual knowledge of their births have been able to relive with extraordinary detail facts concerning their births, such as the use of forceps, breech delivery, and the mother's earliest responses to the infant. Time and time again, details such as these have been objectively verified by questioning hospital records or adults who were present at the time of delivery. Perinatal experiences involve primitive emotions and sensations such as anxiety, biological fury, physical pain and suffocation, typically associated with the birth process. People reliving birth experiences also usually manifest the appropriate physical movements. That is, people in these states of consciousness show the physical movements, such as positioning of their arms and legs, twisting their bodies in ways that accurately recreate the mechanics of a particular kind of delivery. We can observe this with people, even with people who have neither studied nor observed the birth process in their adult lives. Also, and he gets really controversial here, bruises, swellings, and other vascular changes can unexpectedly appear on the skin in the places where the forceps were applied.
where the wall of the birth canal was pressing on the head, or where the umbilical cord was constricting the throat. All these details can be confirmed if good birth records or reliable personal witnesses are available. So you can see in this process lesions happening and then unhappening as these processes are worked through.
I have that rash all over me.
Okay, and that may have deep roots in you.
This
may go back to very early times in your life. These rashes may have appeared and unappeared. Okay. All right, so these early perinatal experiences are not limited to the delivery process. Deep perinatal memories can also provide us with a doorway into what Jung called the collective unconscious. What he's saying is this area is the doorway to the even deeper areas of the collective unconscious and the archetypes. It's not that we can't have collective unconscious and archetypal experiences right now. In fact, we are supposedly motivated at every moment by the collective unconscious and the archetypes, but we generally aren't conscious of those. But every once in a while, we can become conscious of something archetypally. But the full, that's like a window that opens to the conscious mind from the collective unconscious. But to have real access to the collective unconscious, one has to have opened through this area. So you're working kind of, you're the energy that's flowing through a person that has opened this area is a kind of deeper, more universal energy than the me energy. Okay. All right. Collective unconscious. While reliving the ordeal of passing through the birth canal, we may identify with those same events experienced by people of other times and other cultures, or even identify with the birth process experienced by animals or mythological figures. We can also feel a deep link with all those who have been abused, imprisoned, tortured, or victimized in some way. It is as if our own connection with the universal experience of the fetus, struggling to be born, provides us with an intimate, almost mystical connection with all beings who are now or have ever been in similar circumstances. And you understand, present circumstances will bring back the memory or will activate these deeper memories that we all have. So the question, for example, that people who have claustrophobia is, why, when something is close, do you get absolutely terrified? It's the physical threat that you're experiencing in a closed place is not really at life or death level, but you feel it's at life or death level. Why? Because it activates the memory of being locked in the womb that's collapsing around you. So experiences in our current conscious things that happen in our conscious experience can activate or can bring to consciousness, at least partly, these deeper birth imprints. Peter?
It could also be a past life that's forth.
He's coming to that. Yeah, in fact, he's going to talk about how past lives get transferred to this life. Guess what? It goes deeper. I mean, Peter's going to go deeper than this. This is just the doorway to collective and karmic kinds of experience, which are deeper patterns. So what Peter's saying is it might not just be locked in the birth canal, it might have been locked in a dungeon back then. All right. Perinatal phenomena occur in four distinct experiential patterns, which I, Stan Grof, calls the basic perinatal matrices, the BPMs. Multimodal learning. Gotta write it down. Basic perinatal matrices. So this is okay. It says BPMs. each of the four matrices is closely related to one of the four consecutive periods of biological delivery. At each of these stages, the baby undergoes experiences that are characterized by specific emotions and physical feelings. Each of these stages also seems to be associated with specific symbolic images. So this process of birth is not just on a biological level. It's also on a symbolic and a spiritual level. These experiences come to represent highly individualized psycho-spiritual blueprints that guide the way we experience our lives. Okay? What he's saying is the birth process patterns your life. Depending on how you were born, it's a seminal influence on the way your life is structured thereafter. And for some difficulties in people's lives, they're not solvable on the personal unconscious level. They do the psychotherapy and it doesn't work. There's something deeper than that that keeps them in the pattern.
Why would that have evolved?
I'll come back to it in a minute. So the question is, what do you have to do about that? And for some of those difficulties, you need to go to the perinatal level, and for some of those difficulties, you need to go beyond the perinatal level to the past life level or to the karmic level that's in some other sense. So, the experiences of birth may be reflected in individual and social psychopathology, or in religion, art, philosophy, politics, and other areas of life. And of course, we can gain access to these psycho-spiritual blueprints through non-ordinary states of consciousness, which allow us to see the guiding forces of our lives much more clearly. So that's the preamble to the journey. Okay? So the question is, do you want to take the journey?
Yeah.
All right. Because there ain't no turning back down. Here we go. Okay.
You're going to tell us the four patterns?
I'm going to start us through, and I'm probably going to leave us in a bad place, but next week we're going to... All right. I'm going to go as fast as I can here, okay?
Long delivery.
It's a long delivery. Join the club. You know, if there's a... These patterns are... I have some personal familiarity with this stuff because I did work with Stan Grof. So I've kind of studied his stuff. And some of these patterns, even though this sounds crazy, and a lot of people say this guy is crazy and he's probably taking too much of whatever, they explain. There's a lot of explanation that comes here that really rings true to the people who hear the explanation. So if you had a really long delivery, it may be that you're a real late bloomer in life, you know, your rebirth is a kind of extended deal here. First basic perinatal matrix, wholeness and the amniotic universe, BPM1. This is the holotropic mind. If you don't want the Cliff's Notes version, you gotta get this wonderful book. Very clear to read, very compelling. He had a co-writer, so he. The co-writer, Stan writes very dense prose. Brilliant guy. So this is the book that is a little less dense because Hal Zina Bennett kind of made it more accessible. Okay, so. The biological and psychological features of BPM1, Basic Perinatal Matrix 1. The central features of this matrix, as well as the images that flow from it, reflect the natural symbiosis that exists between the mother and child during this period of our lives, when you're in mom's womb. It is important to remember that during this time, we are so intimately connected with the mother, both biologically and emotionally, that we're almost like an organ in her body. During the periods of undisturbed intrauterine life, the conditions for the baby are close to ideal. The oxygen and nutrients needed for growth are continuously supplied by the placenta, which also disposes of all the waste products. The fetus is protected from loud noises and concussions by the amniotic fluid. And the mother's body and the temperature in the womb is kept relatively steady. There is security, protection, and instant effortless gratification of all needs. This picture of life in the womb might look very rosy and wonderful, but it is not consistently so. In the best situations, optimal conditions are disturbed only rarely and for short duration. In the worst situations, life in the womb can be exceedingly uncomfortable. And then he goes on and talks about the various intrauterine disturbances that may have some impact later on. And we know some of that from Bruce Lipton. The anxious mother is going to have a different conformation of the brain of a rat than a non-anxious mother. It's actually going to change the way that the fetus is formed. The fact that a good womb fulfills the fetus's needs unconditionally is the basis for symbolism such as the endless bounties of Mother Nature, an entity that is beautiful, safe, and nourishing. When we are reliving fetal experiences in a non-ordinary state of consciousness, these experiences can suddenly change into gorgeous sceneries portraying luscious tropical islands, fruit-bearing orchards, fields of ripening corn, or the opulent vegetable gardens of the Andean terrace. And you see a lot of art that portrays these paradisical scenes. The reason that we put them on our walls is because they remind us of the paradise of the womb. They resonate deep inside us, and they bring back that feeling of all needs satisfied. Another, and what he would say about art is that art... Chris?
Yeah. It's okay, that one.
I hope. Make sure it's up solid.
It's not.
Chris, do you have that one here before?
I can't remember.
Oh, okay.
So what in a nutshell, what he would say about art is... art has the capacity, because it's symbolic, to evoke the same experience, resonance with the same experiences deep within us. And great art seems to evoke experiences in all of us and at deep levels. And is created from those deep levels and from those universal kind of experiences. So personal art is idiosyncratic. I like it, but it doesn't really speak to you. But great art speaks to us all, and it speaks to us all profoundly. Another possibility is that the fetal experience opens into the archetypal realms of the collective unconscious. And instead of the heaven of the astronomers or the nature of the biologist, we encounter creative realms and gardens of paradise from the mythologies of the world's cultures. The symbolism of BPM-1 thus weaves together in an intimate and logical way various fetal, oceanic, cosmic, natural, paradisian, and celestial elements. So it's a very multimodal experience, and if one goes through this experience on a conscious level, all these elements kind of interweave. There's biological satisfaction of all needs, there's visions of paradise, there's a feeling of unity with everything. Very good experience. This is what Freud called oceanic ecstasy, the melted ecstasy when one feels, and you experience this in your life. The most usual way is when you go to sleep and you let go into everything. That's oceanic ecstasy. When somebody holds you and you melt into them, oceanic ecstasy. I mean, this experience is not unfamiliar to us. The experiences of BPM-1 typically have strong mystical overtones. They feel sacred or holy. More precisely, perhaps, would be the term numinous, which Carl Jung used to avoid religious jargon. When we have experiences of this kind, we feel we've encountered dimensions of reality that belong to a superior order. There's an important spiritual aspect of BPM-1, often described as a profound sense of cosmic unity and ecstasy, closely associated with experiences we might have in a good womb. peace, tranquility, serenity, joy, and bliss. Our everyday perceptions of space and time seem to fade away, and we become pure being. Language fails to convey the essence of this state, prompting most to remark only that it's indescribable or ineffable. But if you've ever had a mystical experience, this is the hallmark of mystical experience, is there's a dissolving of all frames of reference like me, time, and space, and there's a merging completely, either with one thing or with everything. And there's usually a feeling of embracing love. A love that undergirds the moon and the stars. And Graf says the way that we as individuals are imprinted to this experience is from our birth. He's not saying that this experience is just a memory of birth. He's saying that this experience is real, and the way we each get to partake of it is we are born. And in that birth process, we connect with this larger reality. So the rebirth process is a process of remembering our biological birth and reconnecting with this larger reality. Okay, so you got to understand this. He isn't saying that this is just that this feeling of unity is just because we were born. He's saying that because we were born, we can connect with this unity, which is real. All right. We can feel humbled and awed by our own insignificance. We can feel humble and awed by our own insignificance, yet simultaneously have a sense of enormous achievement and importance, sometimes to the extent of identifying ourselves with God. So this is both a realization that as an individual, you're nada, but as a being that is not bounded by her or his individuality anymore, one is everything. So that's the good news. A little bit more, and then we'll move on. Talking about a guy named Ben, and he's telling the story of how Ben went through BPM-1. And then he says, on a different level, Ben also experienced what he was convinced were memories of his past incarnations. It seemed to him that elements of his bad karma had entered his life in the form of embryonal disturbances, the trauma of birth and negative experiences associated with nursing. He saw the experiences of the bad womb, of the trauma of birth, and of the bad breast as points of transformation through which the karmic influences were entering his present life. So this is the way that your soul's journey, your karmic journey gets reactivated now. And Peter, I'm sure, will have a little bit to say about that. Right. In addition to all the above aspects, BPM-1, Basic Perinatal Matrix 1, Wholeness and the Amniotic Universe, okay. BPM-1 also has very interesting associations with memories from postnatal life. The positive aspects of this matrix represent a natural basis for recording all experiences of satisfaction in our lives. During systematic experiential work, people often discover deep connections between the oceanic ecstasy of BPM-1 and memories of happy periods of infancy and childhood, such as carefree and joyful play with peers or harmonious episodes from family life. Satisfying romances and love relationships with intense emotional and sexual gratification also become associated with the positive fetal periods. In deep experiential work, people frequently compare the oceanic ecstasy of the good womb with certain forms of rapture that we can experience as adults. So I said that before. This provides kind of a foundation for adult experiences of merging, of being merged with, and in a good way, with something larger than yourself. So that's BPM-1. And when life is really terrible, and you crawl into bed and turn the electric blanket up to 9 and pull the covers over your head. Freudians would call that regression in the service of the ego, right? Keep yourself from freaking out, you kind of regress. What do you regress to when you crawl into bed and you go like this and you pull the womb? Okay, so there's a little bit of, we recognize this, that when you really regress, you go all the way back. You don't go to childhood, you go all the way back. You know, and you do that every night. All right, here we go. Drumbeat in the distance. Whatever the experience is in the womb, the time arrives when this situation must come to an end. The fetus must undergo the phenomenal transition from a symbiotic aquatic organism to an entirely different form of existence. Even with the smoothest deliveries, this has to be viewed as a major ordeal, a true heroic journey associated with considerable emotional and physical challenge. As the delivery begins, the child's universe within the womb is severely disturbed. The first signs of this disturbance are fairly subtle, coming in the form of hormonal influences. However, they become increasingly dramatic and mechanical with the onset of uterine contractions. The fetus begins to experience intense physical discomfort and a situation of extreme emergency. With the early signs of the beginning of the birth process, the fetal consciousness is introduced into an entirely new set of experiences, quite different from what it's known up to this time. These are the experiences associated with BPM-2, the loss of the amniotic universe and the engagement in the birth process. I don't know what I was saying about it, so I'll come back to it. Okay. Maybe I do. All right, so expulsion from paradise, BPM2. One way to look at the first basic perinatal matrix is the Garden of Eden. You're going to see resonances here. I mean, the reason that people take this seriously is because you see resonances with all the world's spiritual systems, with all the world's art, with all the world's psychologies. I mean, you know, or parts of all the world's psychologies. So those great stories that we have told for thousands of years and the great pieces of art that we think are kind of the most important pieces of art, well, there's the Garden of Eden, right? There's paradise, and then there's Paradise Lost. All right, so. The same womb that throughout the normal pregnancy was relatively peaceful and predictable is now engaging in strong periodic contractions. The entire world of the fetus is closing in and crushing it, causing anxiety and great physical discomfort. So it may be, okay, a little psychopathological note here. Some anxieties and depressive symptoms and other difficulties seem to be traceable to childhood or even more recent events, traumatic events. If you've just been through something traumatic, you're going to probably have anxiety because of the trauma. But some of the anxiety that we experience and some of the depression we experience and some of the other difficulties we experience seems to have deeper root than the Freudian areas, the personal unconscious areas. And the question then becomes, is it necessary to go to the birth trauma to cure yourself of those things? And there are two basic answers to this. One is yeah, that if you don't get the root, you keep cutting the weed down at the level of the lawn, it keeps popping up again. You really got to get it at the root. The other one is, if you are sufficient and in the present, if you can create sufficiently good conditions in your life, that present fertilizer, if you will, or that present good environment will seep down as deep as it needs to go and change even the root of your difficulties. So the two basic philosophies of how to deal with really recalcitrant difficulties in you are, one way is go look for the root, re-experience that, and then put a different plant in there. Other one is create a more ideal situation now in your life and keep recreating that more ideal situation now in your life, and that will eventually change even the deepest levels of difficulty. It will transform even the deepest levels of difficulty. It comes to my mind, a neuropsychological way to look at this is, if you were, some of these patterns have been engraved into your connectome, into your brain, incredibly deeply and incredibly strongly. The question is, can you reroute those circuits? And the question would be, if you work hard enough at present to in a healthier way, will eventually you get rid of the synapses that lead to the old circuits and build synapses that lead to the new circuits? And that's a question that that's a central question in psychology, is to what extent do you need to go back? Okay. So I'm not meaning to say that even if your difficulties are at the birth level, you need to go there. However, as Peter is going to tell you, sometimes you need to go pretty deep, and if you go pretty deep pretty well, you can save yourself a lot of time and a lot of pain. But this is a question we'll go back and forth on a lot. Okay. So let's see. So the entire world of I'm going to leave you in the birth canal. The entire world of a fetus is closing in and crushing it, causing anxiety and great physical discomfort. Each contraction compresses the uterine arteries and interferes with the flow of blood between the mother and the fetus. This is a very alarming situation for the fetus, since it means interruption of the supply of life-giving oxygen and nourishment, as well as the severing of meaningful connections with the maternal organism. At this time, the uterine cervix is still closed. The contractions, closed cervix, and the unfavorable chemical changes combine to create a painful and life-threatening environment from which the fetus can sense no possibility of escape. It is no wonder that death and birth are so closely related in this matrix. The time spent in this difficult no-exit situation varies widely from person to person. For some, it might be minutes, for others, many hours. Feeling stuck is a normal occurrence before the cervix opens, but occasionally the birth process can get arrested at later stages and does not proceed as it should. There are any number of reasons for this to happen. The mother's pelvis might be too narrow, the uterine contractions might be ineffective, or the placenta can block the uterine opening. On occasion, the child is excessively large or lies in an abnormal position that is not conducive to a smooth birth. All these circumstances make the birth longer and more difficult. This clearly has a more traumatic impact on the infant than an easy, normal delivery. So let me say a little something about this now. He's saying that everybody experiences this no-exit situation. It is the biological basis for hell. Hell is a situation where you are trapped forever in unending agony. No exit. That's what Sartre called it, right, in his book, No Exit. No possibility of escape. We all have this, we all can potentially experience this feeling of being trapped with no exit forever. The mistake that I see over and over again clinically is people who are suicidal say, the only way out of this is to kill myself, because there's no way out of it. I've always felt this bad, and I can't see any light anywhere. I got to end this. What Stan would say and what others say is, there's no way out of consciousness. you can kill yourself, but the situation will remain. And furthermore, you've got more karma now because you've screwed up, you've disappointed a lot of other people. And, you know, so that's not the, there's no exit. I'm sorry. You can't get out of it by backing out of it. The only way out of it is the other way. You have to go through it. You can't avoid it. The problem is in when you're stuck in this area really deeply, when people are really deeply depressed and suicidal, they take this experience to be predictive. They say, I'll never get out of this. I've always been like this. There's no light anywhere. What they have to realize is that that's a quality of the experience. It's not actually true. It's the way that they're looking at it right now. And if they're lucky enough to have a guide that can say, let yourself experience that, but don't act on it because it's just the way it looks now. It will look different later. It has to look different later. Nobody stays stuck there forever. But people that get into this experience, they have a very hard time understanding this, and they just can't see their way out of it. So that if you know, if you've ever been in this experience, or if you know people that have this perspective, you have to tell them that it's valid what they're looking at, that it's an experience that we all have. We all have experienced hell in being born, and we all can touch hell in our lives, but it's not the only experience, and it's not predictive in terms of a life course. So you want to ask a question?
Yeah. Who has more experience, influence on the birth situation, the mother or the child being born?
Oh, Stan, I don't know the more, but Stan would say this is a cooperative effort.
Okay.
At first, the mother has more influence, but in BPM-3, when the cervix opens and the child is struggling to be born, then it's a cooperative struggle. The child becomes more empowered as this experience goes on. Okay?
Well, yeah, I have a problem.
Wait. First him, then her. Yeah.
In my situation, I thought I had more control over the birth situation because my mother told me that she was working in the kitchen. And all of a sudden, she felt something coming out. So she wanted to go and lay down in bed and have birth. But by the time she got to birth, I was out.
So you were...
I wanted to get out.
Yeah, but and also, you had smooth karma. I mean, this process happened very readily and easily for you. For other people, it's very, very, very different and creates a very, very different psyche. I mean, you look, all right, I'm going to use him as an example. You know, this is how Grafian psychology works. He just thinks, well, I'm going to become a poet. And so he learns how to become a poet. And I'm going to publish a book. And I'm going to do it. He just thinks it and it happens. He doesn't see what most of us see, which is, well, I don't know anything about becoming a poet. And I'm a lousy writer anyway. And how am I going to get the book together? And, you know, obstacle. Why does that happen? Well, the prototype of it isn't a birth with obstacles, if you will. It sets the pattern. Okay, Julie was next, and then we'll go to Rich.
I had double birth on a long had cold chin. And, what do you call it? A miscarriage. And then she had a hard time getting me up. I lost oxygen, and I had a DNA invade over a week, and then I got brain damage.
Yeah, so because of the circumstances of your birth, there was some, it was a difficult birth, and it had some consequences for your life.
Yeah.
All of us have had some level of difficulty in our births, and it has had some consequence for our lives.
Mm-hmm.
The list of consequences is as great as the personalities that are sitting here. So, Julie, you're in the same boat as everybody else. You just have one that you can identify really easily. Other folks aren't so clear about why their life... You know, Paul Simon said, some folks' lives roll easy as a breeze rolling through a summer's day, you know. But most folks' lives, they stumble and they fall. Through no fault of their own, most folks never catch their stars. Question is why that is? This is one set of answers. Okay, Richard.
Yeah, what's Brad say about C-section?
I'm going to come to it later, but all right. I'll give you the punchline to that now. What does he say about C-sections? I'll give you the punchline to that now, and then, where is it? Okay, let me see if I can find it really quick. Okay, here we go. I know where it is. Okay. All right, this is at the very end. Okay. This is bound to be controversial, folks. There we go. And now we're skipping to the very end. We're going to come back. And then I got to kind of leave you in a not such a... I got to pull you out a little bit here. Okay. Uncomplicated birth seems to be the blueprint for coping with all later difficult situations in life. If you had a good birth, you're kind of equipped to cope. Various complications, such as prolonged and debilitating delivery, the use of forceps, or heavy anesthesia, all three. many of us had anesthesia. By the way, there's some thought that maybe the fact that we go to drugs when anything goes wrong has some prototype early, you know, whenever anything goes wrong. So various complications such as prolonged and debilitating delivery, use of forceps, or heavy anesthesia appear to be correlated to specific problems in dealing with future projects of all kind, that is, giving birth to things. The same is true for induced birth, premature delivery, and cesarean section. I have heard Stan say that the problem with C-section is you don't get enough BPM-3. You don't get enough struggle and triumph. So C-section kids tend to it's too easy for them. It just kind of happens. It kind of happens too easily, and they don't have the same level of titanic struggle and tremendous achievement that kids that had a longer time in the process have. Now, I don't know if that's true or not. You want to do some graduate research on it? I'm sure it would be good graduate research. But that's what he says. So he says that basically the way we birth our people now, and we have with especially with anesthesia and taking the kid away from the mother right after birth, that they used to do more, but they still do to some extent. All that stuff has huge consequences for personality, and maybe the lousy mess that the world is in now is because the world went from good birth, natural birthing processes to these more clinical birth processes, and that is being reflected in the depression, anxiety, and other problems that we see epidemic in the world. Okay, so let me say a summary. We're going to keep going. It'll take us one more week to get through the whole process. This is the divine comedy. Right now, we have gone from the middle of the dark forest in the middle of our lives into hell. Okay, when the cervix is closed, it is hell. Okay, and that's the prototype of those kind of experiences for all of us. Where we're going to go is we're going to go to BPM-3. We have a little more BPM-2 to do. We're going to go to BPM-3, where we begin to climb out of hell by our own efforts and the efforts of our mother into purgatory. And then eventually it's going to be a comedy. We're going to get to an amazing place for having gone through this death rebirth process. Okay. So if you can hold on for a while and realize that this too will pass, then it will pass into something a lot that is worth the difficulty. However, I think you probably shouldn't be preoccupied with how bad things are this week. I think you should keep a balance, and it is really true that the psyche wants to keep rebalancing. You go into difficulty, and then the psyche naturally, if you don't stay preoccupied by the difficulty, naturally will give you some affirmation to keep you balanced. So you move maximally well through your growth process if you open to what's there, deal with it, and then open further so that the rebalancing process keeps you. Negative, positive, negative, positive, negative, positive. That keeps you moving through maximally well. If you stay preoccupied with what's wrong, you stay stuck. You stick yourself. Don't stick yourself. Okay. All right. So people who need to leave really...